You know, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know. Using TrueCar can also help you buy a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles, that's used cars, available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Whether you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers discounts off the list price for used cars and a better buying experience through the TrueCar certified dealer network. There are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. You'll see what other people paid for the car you want so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the new or used car you want. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states, and I'm not going to tell you which states and which features. That's not my job.
Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable Cars and Coffee hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast Spike Ferriston and recorded live from the porch of the famous Malibu Kitchen, where Spike and his celebrity guests sip some Java, talk life, and of course, talk cars. Now, here's Spike.
Hello, here we are back on the porch of the Malibu Kitchen. This is Spike's Car Radio. I'm Spike Ferriston. In case you don't know me, sometimes people don't know me, Paul. I'm going to tell everybody who I am. I'm Spike Ferriston. I was a writer on Seinfeld. I wrote on Saturday Night Live for a little while, but mostly known for Seinfeld and Letterman. I've hosted late-night shows, and most recently I hosted Car Matchmaker on Esquire Network, and then Esquire went out of business. But we have some good news on that front coming soon. I can't tell you now, but I promise I will tell you soon. In the meantime, we're out here in the porch of at the Malibu Kitchen at the Malibu Country Mart every weekend doing podcasts. And it's a lot of fun. And I'm here with Paul Zuckerman, attorney at law and car collector extraordinaire and a hammer. This guy is just a hammer. He's a fixer. You have a problem, he will take care of it, especially problems with you in your personal life. Right, Paul?
If you're my friend, if you're my friend and you have a problem,
it's really useful to know a lawyer like you.
It's a very narrow skill set, but if the problem falls between these goalposts, I'm going to be the best kicker you've ever needed.
Well, we have a great podcast today. We're waiting for Jeremy Piven, who's the star of the new CBS drama Wisdom of the Crowd, coming Sundays this fall, 8, 7 Central. They always take care of the Central people. They always got to make sure the Central Time people are taken care of.
And there's nobody there.
And there's nobody there. Nobody's nobody. Watching TV.
Do you know Jeremy Piven?
I met him here on the porch. I met him here. He came up to us and he was asking about old 911s. He wanted to buy one. You remember that? You were with me, right?
I don't think I was.
Well, I guess it was Jerry and I, and he walked up and said hello and said, "Can you guys find me an early 70s 911 Targa?" And I guess we'll get into that. But first, before he shows up, because he's going to be here any minute, this legal career of yours, is it ever useful? You collect cars. People don't know that about you. You have an amazing collection of Porsches, a couple of Mercedes, one Ferrari. When you get involved with a dealer or a seller where things don't go right and you've been taken advantage of, do you hammer them? Does it help to be you in that situation?
It's kind of like cursing. If you curse all the time, the words lose their effect. And so you must deploy your curses judiciously and sparingly. And it's the same way about deploying that you're a lawyer. A lot of times, if we're in the middle of doing a business deal, they're getting emails or correspondence that indicate that it's from my firm,
right,
who I am and what I do. So I don't need to repeat myself.
Right. But are there, I know some of the dealers you deal with, and some of them, I feel like it's evenly matched. Like, these are the best of the best at kind of ripping you off. it's not even that. I don't mean to communicate it that way, but, you know, getting past maybe a little lie in an automotive transaction.
So it helps. Being from the lawyer world helps in this way. I am used to the fact that people have a very loose relationship with the truth.
Right.
I am used to the fact that most of the things people say, it's not really quite accurate, and people really don't know what is accurate. You know, this perception.
Exactly. Can you tell when someone's lying over the phone? Are you that good?
Sometimes.
And
yes.
What's the tell?
Well, if you're talking about a salesman, if we're talking about car
salesmen. About anybody.
Well, that's a little bit harder. Car salesmen tend to engage in hyperbole, and I know what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And the more somebody speaks in grand terms in hyperbole and simile, mm-hmm. the more they're likely lying. If they start to get into specific facts, usually they know what they're talking about.
So if you get screwed on a car, what are your options? Let's say, I know we have lemon laws, right? That
generally.
But what about with the used stuff, the old stuff?
Well, okay. I can speak a little bit about personal experience. In terms of personal experience, I have made mistakes. And I tend to view making mistakes as paying tuition in the school of car
yes.
buying.
But
tuition
what
in
do
the
you
school-
do when you know you've been screwed?
Sometimes, I'll give a specific example.
Yes.
There was a dealer on Long Island who sold me a car that he said was freshly restored.
Okay.
That it was perfect. And when it arrived, I could see three different colors of paint coming through the surface. And it barely
really?
Ran.
Long Island?
Long Island.
That surprises me.
It surprises me.
Yes. But continue.
And so I called him up and I said to him that we were just going to pretend that this deal never happened. That I was not going to yell and scream. I was not mm-hmm. going to make threats. That we were just going to have a do-over.
Right.
That I was going to send the car back to him and he was going to send my money
okay.
back to me. And that we would remain friends. And that kind of stated everything mm-hmm. that I needed to state, which was if he didn't do what I wanted, we weren't going to be friends, and that I was going to handle it, and he did the right thing. I think very few times have I been. There was one time, yes, where I was spectacularly ripped off.
Mm-hmm. And I think I know the car.
Yes,
this was a car that might have been welded two different cars together, right?
Yes,
the
it
front
was.
Of a part of a car and the back up.
Yes, it was. The front of it was a 67, and the back of it was a 68.
Right. And the salesman said to you, "This isn't my problem."
Yes.
And you famously said back.
Well, I famously said back to him, "It's your problem if I decide it's your problem."
See, I don't think people who aren't lawyers know they can say things like that, because it was effective, and you ended up getting your money back. And the guy, the salesman, I think if I remember correctly, didn't even work for the dealership anymore.
Right. So I'm going to have to correct you, because your version of the story is much better than really what happened.
Right.
And what happened is that the guy, the dealership that I had bought it from, was closed. Because, mm-hmm. unsurprisingly, he was a bad guy, and he went bankrupt. And the guy that I was going after didn't have anything. It just so happened that the work on the car itself was good enough. I gave it to a reputable car dealer, and that guy told everybody what the car really was. And we sold it, and I got almost all of my money out of it. It went to
wow.
another dealer.
Somebody bought it and didn't care that it was two different cars welded together.
It turned out that it was another dealer who didn't care that it was two cars welded together. And then I saw it advertised again falsely.
Wow.
And I sent an email to that new dealer saying, you know, this was my car, and I don't see that you're advertising it properly, and I
wow.
sure hope that you do the right thing and tell people what this car really is.
Right. Why are people welding two different cars together? Like, you know, it's interesting. Where I grew up in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts, there was one exotic car dealership. It was called Tech Motors, and the FBI shut them down one day for welding cars together. Why? What is that? Is that just, you know, taking one car with a proper VIN that's not a salvage title, but it doesn't have a back half? Or is it hybrid cars? Do you have any clue what that
yes.
is?
Yes. Why do people sell baby powder as cocaine? One
right.
thing doesn't cost a lot, and the other thing has great value.
I hear you. Wow. You really get your ear to the bad stuff.
Okay.
I love it. That's why I love you, Zuckerman. You're really the underbelly of the car world. That's where you're at, and you're not afraid of it. You're not afraid of any of it.
What
just before, because Jeremy Piven's going to be here any second, what can people do who aren't lawyers, who don't know anybody, who've been screwed on a car deal? What do you recommend?
I think the first thing The first thing is that you have to do your due diligence in advance.
Right.
You always have to find somebody, a third party, to do what's known as a PPI, a pre-purchase inspection, somebody that knows what it is that you're buying.
Yeah, we know that, but when you get screwed, what do?
Most times you're out of luck, and most times getting your money back is much of an uphill battle because the guy who's engaging in fraud is usually fly by night. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have a bank account. He's doing it because he's going under. I don't think many people went into the used car or the classic car business saying, aha, I've got a great idea. I'm going to do it all the wrong way, and I'm going to commit fraud. So in the state of California, the laws are very favorable to the consumer. You can hire a lawyer, and if they have money, you can beat the crap out of them in California.
So that's what you have to look for. You have to see if they have money.
Yes.
And if they do,
you can take action. Right.
But you need to hire a lawyer. But isn't the cost of that lawyer going to just be expensive? There's no other options here?
In the state of California.
Well, even outside the state of California. Not everybody.
California makes it very attractive to the lawyer who is pursuing it on your behalf because attorney's fees are part of the compensation.
It's
built into the law. If you were
That's
in a state
good. I like
you,
that.
If you were in a state that did not allow you to collect your attorney's fees, then you're screwed. Then you're paying out of pocket.
I love it. All right, well, look, Jeremy Piven's here. I'm sorry to interrupt. He's over there looking at a dog right now. He's playing with Eli's dog. Our friend Eli Kogan brought his German Shepherd here, as he is wont to do. That's a dog he puts in a Porsche, which I do not approve of.
I don't approve of
and
it
now,
at all.
And I'm just surprised. Jeremy Piven has a dog as well.
Is that his
dog?
That is a French.
All right, let's wave him over here. Jeremy Piven, ladies and gentlemen, we're waiting for you. Sit down. You brought your dog.
I did bring my dog.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, man.
Good to see you. This is Paul Zuckerman.
Nice to meet you, Jeremy.
My co-host. He's a lawyer. Anything you say might incriminate you. Be careful. You need any legal advice? He'll take care of that too.
I hope not. But anything is possible, man. It's always good to know another lawyer that's part of the team.
Do you come here often? Do you come to the Malibu Kitchen?
It's a great opening line, by the way.
What's that?
You come here often. It's just genius. Thank you. I want you on 11 different levels after saying that because it's just so unique. And
well, it's where we met.
It's where we met.
Who is your dog here? What?
That was my dog Bubba.
Oh, here it is. Hi, Bubba. What kind of dog is this? It's a little brown bulldog.
It is a blue. You're colorblind, which is an interesting start. It's a blue French bulldog. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. I mean, I can tell you where they were, why they
oh,
were.
Oh, wait,
bred.
Wait! Now he's taking off. Look, the dog has run away.
You know what?
Oh, he's over there.
Can you just throw this on him?
We're gonna put him on a leash.
There goes
Will, our producer. He's gonna go put him on a leash and. Hopefully he won't sell them for crack. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure, my
It's
honor.
So nice to have you here so
Good
early
to be
on.
Here.
We've been talking about Wisdom of the Crowd.
Okay.
Coming Sundays on CBS.
That's right.
And it's when is your start date?
October 1st.
And is this, let's get into that later. There's so much I need to talk to you about that's car related first.
Okay.
Because
first things first, yeah.
First things first. Because I see you in Hollywood years ago driving, is it a Bronco? Was that the first car that you had in Hollywood that you may still have right now?
Yeah, I've had that car forever. I love it. I just love these old Ford Broncos because they're perfect for Malibu.
Right.
Because they're kind of sturdy and they're up high and it's a ragtop and you get to see and feel everything. So that's why, I mean, you know that I'm in love with Targas as well. So.
Yeah.
I love Porsches and the whole history of them, but I also kind of want something that, because I'm from Chicago, so it's, you know, we grew up having these kind of vicious seasons. Mm-hmm. So the idea of having beautiful weather, like, I just want to put the top down. So
and how long have you had the Bronco?
I've had the Bronco like 20 years.
Wow.
Long time.
And where did you get it? Where did you find it?
I found it from a guy that I don't really want to say just because he was kind of a charlatan, just incredibly.
We were just talking about
this. Just a really sketchy dude.
So what happened? It was a bad transaction? The car, it wasn't right?
You know, it just, you get the car and Listen, I'm a, here. Let's start by saying
you've got a lawyer right here who can help you. He can get you some
money. Because I'm a dummy. Because the reality is, like, you know, I don't know a lot about cars.
Well, this happens to all of us. This actually happens to all of us. But what happened?
Well, no, it's just, you know, you overpay for a car and the engine's not great and you learn your lessons and that's how it goes.
There you go.
Tuition in the school of life, as I said.
Tuition in the school of life, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
But now, though, I mean, if this is 20 years ago, you're doing all right, right?
You know, I still have a Bronco and I'm still looking for cars, so I haven't really evolved in that particular arena. You know me.
I also know, and, you know, James Spader was the first guy to point this out to me. He said it's really important for him that this transaction, the car that you're going to buy and the seller, that it all feels good because you carry that into the driving experience in the future.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's true at this point? Are you over yet? Or are you holding grudges 20 years?
I think you and Jerry are spiritually tied to cars, and I respect it and I love it, but I don't quite get it yet, but I want to get it.
This was Spader. This was James Spader.
Well, and Spader and you and your whole crew.
Right.
I don't have the connection to cars that you do.
Oh,
but
you
I want it.
You've got a Bronco you kept for 20 years.
Right.
You came up to us on the porch here, and you said, I want to get into a 911 Targa.
Correct.
Right?
So I want to be a part of it. I just haven't had that connection that you've had. I'm just being honest with you.
Well, that's it. That's all we're doing. We're just looking at cars and buying cars and then driving them.
But I mean, you guys are in love with the stories of these cars, and you have a connection to it, and that's real. And I think whoever had my car before drove a van very slowly, you know, past schools and, you know, did bad things.
And you, it 20 years later, it's not sorted. We'll help you with that.
Bro,
we're going to help
you
with that.
You know, it's up to us. We can't be, you know, we got to just take care of ourselves. This is going to get very deep here, but, you know, you can take on some weird bad karma and work through it yourself.
Right.
You know,
what was your first car? Did you like kids? You grew up in Chicago, right?
I grew up just outside of Chicago on the north side of a place called Evanston, and like the end of my street was technically Chicago, Howard Street and whatnot. So I'm a Cubs fan, Northsider. And, you know, I grew up incredibly wealthy. No, not at all. No. I was a part of a theater family, and we lived like in an old folks' home because, you know, my parents, you know, they're theater animals. And they have a school, the Piven Theater, which is still thriving to this day. And, you know, I didn't know any better, so I thought, you know, there were a lot of people around me that were octogenarians, and everyone had a neck brace. And as a child, I thought, this is what everyone – oh, perfect. Oh, I think it's going really well.
All right.
There you go.
That happens. That's part of doing business here in a parking lot.
Absolutely.
But why an old age home? What's the connection to theater there?
Well, the connection is you don't get paid if you do theater, and we had no money.
Right.
And so the cheapest place to live was this old folks' home, and that's how I grew up, and it was great. And I wouldn't change it for anything because I grew up in the theater with a family that loved to create. And after school, you know, I loved to play football. And when I wasn't playing football, I was on stage from the time I was 8 years old doing improv and scene study, I was exposed to really great literature, you know, I was butchering Chekhov early, very early, and Kurt Vonnegut and all this great stuff. And I know that you and Jerry hate talking shop about this stuff.
I love Kurt Vonnegut.
It's very awkward.
Jerry's not here.
You want to talk more about engines.
He's gone. He's taken off. No, I work in entertainment like you, and I like cars. Yeah. I don't know what this podcast is. It seems to be a blend of entertainment and cars and just whatever.
I love it.
That's what podcasting is. I hear. Yeah. But I love what you're saying. So from there, at what point do you leave the old age home, which you're headed back to, by the way?
You know what? I think at a certain point, you know, I remember having a bar mitzvah and not having any money, but not even knowing that other kids had money. Like, I was the DJ for my own bar mitzvah. It was, literally, it was in a basement.
That's
great. I got a hand job. It was huge, man. It was just like, it was unbelievable. My life was.
Did you give yourself the hand job too?
I did.
The it DJ was. It, hand.
Yeah, it was,
I'm going to do this for myself.
Listen, I was self styled, but it was still a win. And I think I peaked. I peaked at 13. What can I say?
Fantastic. And then, so where is the first car on this timeline?
You know, the first car wasn't until I was 21 years old. Even though I started working at about 18, I,
Doing what?
My first movie actually was playing a character called Spike in a movie called Lucas with Charlie Sheen and a bunch of people, and David Seltzer, who is you know, very prolific writer director, wrote Damien Omen and all that kind of stuff. Wow, and I there I was, 18 years old, doing a movie, and that was my first like really kind of paid gig, and it was unbelievable. And Charlie Sheen was one of these guys who was from Malibu, and you know, and I thought, oh my God, what is that like there? That's some incredible place where Martin Sheen lives, and how is that even possible that anyone lives there? And here we are in Malibu all these years later. But I have to say, and I'm not like outing Charlie because he's already, you know, quite an eccentric character. But
I think Charlie outs our Charlie.
Yes, he does. He does a nice job. But I will say that, you know, he's always been very. He's been that guy since he was 18 years old.
Right.
So he was Charlie Sheen when we were 18 years old.
You know, we were at Dodger Stadium last night, and cameras go on Will Ferrell. He's behind home plate. Crowd cheers. Yeah. Camera went on Jerry Seinfeld. We were with Jerry Lesson. Crowd cheers.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the ninth inning, Charlie Sheen walks in.
Yeah.
And they went crazy for him.
Yes.
People went absolutely crazy for him.
Well, Major League, which I was actually in as
well. Is that what it is?
That's the variable, yeah. Well, I don't know what it is. I don't know anything about pop culture.
No, it seemed like they were relating to him, that they'd say, you know, you're like us. You're broken like us. I don't know, but people were thrilled to see him in the ballpark.
He's a huge baseball fan.
Right.
But I remember, dude,
he's also coming to the
game. He has a very particular Malibu accent. And at 18 years old, he goes, dude, I swear to God, there I am thinking, I'm getting paid to act. It was the greatest moment of my life. And he said to me, I'll never forget, and there he was. I was like, this guy is like a movie star. He's Martin Sheen's son. This is like another world. I get to put on football pads again. I thought I was done.
Right.
I was a Jewish linebacker in high school, never to play again. I'm in football pads and living the dream. And he goes, dude, the only way I'm getting through this movie is with a 12-pack and a fucking big fat joint, dude. And the director comes
over. And the
director comes over and goes, we'll get right on that for you, Charlie. And he goes, dude, I forgot I had my mic on, dude. The worst. So that was like my introduction to movie.
And you're
making.
21 at that.
I'm
age.
18 years old.
18 years. That's so irresistible when that happens, right? Do you feel like now I have found my place in life? That this is where.
Well,
I need
you know,
to be.
I wasn't.
You're
you know,
working
I was.
And you're
I was a kid from you know from the Midwest. I wasn't. You know,
I know,
I wasn't
but that's irresistible.
Well,
I would have died if that happened to me.
What was irresistible was like the idea because I did. I really did love acting. And so we got to improvise in that movie. So the idea that could be your life, like I'd always been a part of the theater, but you don't get paid in the theater. And I thought, you know, the brass ring will be on the Goodman Theater and, you know, kind of stay locally. But then I was like, wait a minute, I can be in front of the camera. So that
your parents are thrilled, right? Or weren't they not?
No,
because you weren't on Broadway.
No, they were thrilled. They were thrilled. And I got to pay for college and then went to NYU and kept going. And, you know, and here we are.
And
those
here
are cliff
we
notes.
Are. And it ends here on the porch looking for 9/11 targets, which
That's
is
right.
a great place for it to be.
Absolutely.
So at what point does Entourage come along? Because I think, I asked Jerry this question, I'll ask you the same thing. What's the thing everybody says to you when they see you? Is that the show they talk about?
Well, absolutely. In this country, and when I go to London, it's Mr. Selfridge. Mr. Selfridge for the past
Which
4 years.
Which is wonderful itself.
Thank you. And then Mr. Selfridge was did really well overseas, and then over here it was picked up by PBS. And PBS, their entire budget for advertising is $11, and I didn't know that. And then once the show went up, and I was like, you know, very excited, and there were no ads. And I went to them and said, can we take out any ads? And they laughed for about 16 minutes.
Yeah.
And then that was the end of that conversation. So it was
they didn't need to do that. Downton Abbey was huge at that moment. And then your promo would run right after that. And we all said, we're watching Mr. Selfridge now.
Well, that's kind of you. But what I didn't what you
I
were,
didn't
you,
have to look at a TV guide to know
well,
about Downton
right,
Abbey
you
or
were,
Mr.
You
Selfridge.
You were one of the few people that got
and
a
I,
chance
but,
to watch
And
that.
I liked you because I always liked you because of the Bronco. And Entourage,
oh, okay.
Those two things. Wait, so, tell me how Entourage comes about, first of all. Where does that, do they come to you and go, we want you to play this guy?
Not at
or
all.
They come to you and just
not
say, we have an agent character?
I'm in my mid-30s. I'm probably 40 movies into my career. I'm now got a lot of opportunities. I mean, I'm doing films, but I have a lot of opportunities in television to kind of star and actually produce TV shows. This show comes along, and I know a couple of my friends were up to write it, and they didn't get the gig. And I knew Mark Wahlberg, and I knew this was about his life, and I knew that he was an incredibly, like, charismatic guy, Wahlberg is. And he's, you know, he's... They wanted to do something that was kind of an homage to the backstage journey of his life. And so I knew that that people would want to see that. And HBO was the best home at the time, I felt, because of the quality of shows.
Right.
You have Sopranos,
right.
Sex and the City, and all that stuff. So I went in. They basically said, they want you to audition for... The fifth lead, there's one scene. It's a pilot. You have one quick scene. It's the agent, and it's a quote unquote fringe player,
right?
And they want you to audition. Player. And I remember at the time going, well, wait a minute. You know, I've done all these movies, and I've done the lead in a bunch of TV shows and stuff. Maybe I could meet on this role, because this isn't a lead.
Right.
It's a tiny role, but I love the idea of
this. Why? In other words, why aren't they just giving it to me?
Well, that's all part of it, and. And,
you've earned the right to just... They know who you are. They've seen what you've done.
Right. And so...
But they want to hear your words. They want to hear you speak.
They do want to hear it, and that was like a turning point moment for me.
And you have trouble doing that?
No, I love auditioning. I love being humiliated and bending down on one knee and asking someone to marry me and having them reject me over and over again.
But I'll tell you, somebody who's a showrunner, I love to hear you say the lines.
You love to hear your words. You're in love with your words.
No,
I get it.
No, it's not about the words. I love the guy. And I'll tell you why. Because every time someone like you comes in the room, I realize, oh, there's someone who – there's the part. There's the guy I was thinking of. It's never the words.
You're being very kind,
guy.
And that's – You
but
know,
that happens to me listen, over and over again.
Well, listen, if that's the reality that you have to audition, you do it. But if there's a possibility to go in there and sit down and talk to them about the piece and the role and your ideas for how you would play it, you know, that's something that you, an actor, dreams about. That's something so civilized, because we've auditioned our whole lives.
Right.
I have enough rejection for 16 lifetimes easily. You know what I mean?
And we all do. It's a brutal, brutal business.
Yeah, and it's all part of it. But if someone knows your work and they're familiar with it, and you want to talk about what the role could be and what the journey of all that is. So ultimately, I said to my agent, this is an important moment. If we kind of put our foot down and say, listen, let's go in and talk about this, because it was a tiny role. And... So they finally said, yeah, okay. And I went in and talked to him, and I knew Ari Emanuel, who the role was based on. And so I went in.
He's an agent. Was he at William? He runs William Morris, right?
He had his own place called Endeavor.
Endeavor,
and
right.
And then he bought William Morris, and it was William Morris Endeavor, and then he just bought the UFC. And
so you're,
soon
you knew
he'll
him,
be president.
And there you go. Yes. And did they already have that idea for that character, or you walked in with that idea and said,
no,
I want to play Ari Emanuel?
No, I mean, the character's called Ari. Mark Wahlberg's agent is Ari Emanuel.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to be a detective to break this shit down. It's pretty...
What did you do? Did you do an impression of him? I mean, how did...
I went in a power suit. I knew Ari had been my agent. I knew he's a, you know, a second-generation Israeli. So he's exactly what I played. He's a very, like, high-strung, ambitious, intelligent... reactive guy who lives in these beautiful dualities where you think he's a pig, but he's monogamous, and all these beautiful things that I knew that if they gave me a shot, that there's something beautiful about this character that could really take off. And I knew that the pedigree of shows at HBO would support it. So it sounds like I'm Monday morning quarterbacking, and I'm just being honest with you that I knew there was something there.
Right.
So I took the role for, you know, basically a 10% of my quote, and... you know, they just basically, they have really nothing for me because, you know, it's an ensemble show and here it's a small role. And I just knew that if I could kind of get in there and mix it up, that something would come of it.
Wow. And then it becomes your show, really. It really, the whole series becomes about Ari, our favorite character.
Well, that's very sweet of you.
I know you can't say that, but I'm going to say that.
Well, you know, it's...
And you people, so that they think you're Ari now when they're walking around? Do they call you an asshole?
Well,
and they go, oh, you're such an ass. They do this to Larry David because of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Well, I love you, man. You're such an asshole.
Well, but there's a difference. And I think, and what's interesting about this is, you know, Larry David is, and he'll have to obviously speak for himself. First of all, he's a genius. And I was lucky enough to work with him for a bit on Entourage.
But, and Seinfeld.
And Seinfeld, that's absolutely.
Right.
Which one of my favorite moments of all time was being directed by Larry how to play it and have Jason telling me how to play it as well. And then I was trying to play it. So you had three versions
of the same character.
Of the same character. You know, theirs being much better than mine. So
right.
But it was amazing. I was just doing a version of theirs.
You were emanating the TV George, right?
I was a TV George emanating from the source of the actual.
The TV George.
Right.
Oh, my God. All right. Very well, we're going to have more from Jeremy Piven right after this, everybody. Don't go away.
Adam Carolla's motivational podcast, Take a Knee, is a part of Podcast One Premium. But you can hear a very special episode with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar now for free at podcastone.com.
How much do you think that discipline has affected your life and helped you in further endeavors after
sports? It's helped me a lot because, you know, when you get to a point when you can look back, all the times that I failed had to do with my own laziness and arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when you get humble and understand that you got to work for it and earn it, you get things done.
To subscribe and get a new episode of Take a Knee each week, go to podcastone.com/premium.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
All right, here we are. We're back with Jeremy Piven and his dog. And at The Real Zuckerman. Are you even on social media? You're on Twitter, right? I follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, and Instagram, Jeremy Piven Official.
We were just talking about baseball during the break.
Yes.
And I remember seeing your first pitch.
Yeah.
It was impressive. You did it for the Cubs, right?
I did it with the Cubs. The only reason it was impressive is because your expectations were so low. Let's be honest.
It's hard. You're far away on the mound. I did one last year for the Angels, and it's a little scary. And yes. You're a very famous person, and you don't want to Bubba Booey it, as we all know.
Well, let me ask you, did you practice?
No, they.
Okay, that's the problem.
I did not.
You got to practice.
But I did okay. I played baseball. I was fine.
There you go. So you have a reference for it.
Yeah. But your pitch was, frankly, it was much better than mine. It was faster. It was the only strike.
The only reason that happened was because growing up, I was a dummy and played football. So instead of playing something for my size, which should have been baseball or even soccer, I played football. I went to a school with about 5,000 kids. I was the only white boy that played on my football team. And I think that's part of my, you know, makeup of who you are and all that kind of stuff because – you know, it was really difficult. I mean, I started off in junior high school grinding, and I was a fullback and loved it. By the time I got to high school, they were like, "You're a white boy, and there's no way you're in this backfield." And I desperately wanted to be in the backfield, and they said it's not happening. So that was part of my first rejection.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get to your new show in a second, but I have more questions. I noticed in your bio, your brother-in-law is Adam McKay.
Yes.
What is that like? Because Adam McKay, the super successful director Adam McKay, same guy,
is
married to your sister.
My sister, Shira.
Do you feel any sort of competition with him, or is it different because he's not an actor and he's a director? Or?
You know, it's so funny. First of all, it's a great question, and I like that you're just starting your podcast. It's like, a really, really great question, because let's get to the bottom of this, because this is important stuff.
It is important.
If people remember one thing, remember this. Another person's, and this is gold, man. If you own this, you will fly. Another man's success will never, ever, ever, ever take away from your own. Ever. Ever. Wow.
There you go.
And by the way, he is the sweetest, funniest, most kind of humble, self-deprecating guy.
He's amazing.
He's incredible. You know, he's a guy who went from, you know, the head writer on SNL doing his thing. He and Will partnered up and did Funny or Die. And he wrote and directed Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, The Other Guys, all that stuff, and then transitioned into a little drama called The Big Short and won this tiny award called the Oscar on his first try. So, you know, but, you know, he's not a guy.
How long did it take you to get to that realization, though? You don't seem like a person that would be jealous of anyone else's career.
That's very sweet of you, and that's a huge compliment.
But were you? And who is it?
You know, who am I jealous of? Well, listen, I'm not jealous of, but I love...
I think a certain amount of jealousy is normal when you see somebody doing well. It's just a little ping sometimes. I get my stomach like, ah.
There are guys like Robert Downey who, first of all, I just did a movie with Jamie Foxx called All-Star Weekend where we play a couple guys who... I'm obsessed with Steph Curry. He's obsessed with LeBron James. And Robert Downey comes in and plays this brilliant cameo, and he's so ridiculously creative. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why he's doing what he's doing. But I'm not going to lie to you. How fun would that be to play Iron Man?
Yeah.
And he plays him with an edge, and Favreau lets him improvise, and he's living.
Have you ever been offered movies like that? I would imagine you've been offered all sorts of movies like that.
You know what?
You know, what is your barometer of what you're looking to do and not do? You know.
Well, I would love to. I mean, even going toe to toe with him for the bit that we did in that movie too. To do one of those big fun action movies with him or someone like that and work with those guys and mix it up would be incredible. I'm about to start, as you mentioned earlier, I'm starring and producing a TV show for CBS called Wisdom of the Crowd.
So you're also producing that?
I am producing it, yeah.
And so did you go in? Were you there for the initial pitch? Were you attached to it then at that
point? It's interesting. The initial pitch was an Israeli pitch. Kashet, who also did... Homeland.
Mm-hmm.
The pitch was, here's a guy who I'm playing who is a tech billionaire whose daughter is murdered, and he's obsessed with finding the killer because he feels like they got the wrong guy. So he sells his entire fortune for pennies on the dollar and decides to create a real-time crowdsourced crime-solving site to figure this out. And it's a great idea. And so the idea was bought by CBS, and that's when they came to me. And it's just the guy's a real human being. He's completely heartbroken. He's not dealing with his grief properly. And I think that's a brilliant premise.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we can go anywhere with it.
Right.
Because I want to figure out who did this. And the lengths that I will go to are, I think, are going to be kind of interesting. And mm-hmm. you know, as a writer, it's very a fertile premise.
Well, I love what's going on Twitter right now with Donald Trump and the whole Russian thing. And there are all sorts of people open sourcing and crowdsourcing information.
Yes. But do you think that a real-time crowdsourced crime-solving site is realistic in today's day and age?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, it's already happening. I can tell you right now, because I started a production company a year ago, and I pitched an idea like this to my partner, not a scripted one. I'm not going to get – there's no lawsuit
coming.
I wish
you weren't such a big shot that you'd come right on my show. But I know you have to be executive
producer
creator.
I would love to, but I don't know how to write drama. But I was showing my partner, I'm like, look at all the crimes that are getting solved by people just getting involved on the internet and open sourcing information and just looking behind doors. And it's astounding. It's really amazing. I think it's a great premise for a show. Well, are you now, though, but here's what I'm fascinated by. Are you going to all the producer meetings? Are you sitting down with the network for that big notes session? Or do you stay out of that? Or do you like that stuff?
Because
it makes me crazy.
It does. I think with me it's interesting because when you have an actor, I wasn't involved from the very beginning.
Right.
So because I wasn't involved in the very first pitch,
right.
I'm not like legally and technically allowed to kind of be at all these meetings. And the reality is, as you know, is the network is talking about me in those
right.
meetings
no,
as well.
Right, no, I know. And
so
they get nervous about that.
They're not going to look me in the face and say, I wish Piven was better. I wish he was better looking and more sincere in his performance and had more dimension. You know?
No. Have you noticed? Because I'm on camera too, and frequently when I am, I'm also the executive producer.
Right.
They try to marginalize me for that very same reason. They try to push me aside a little bit so they can be very honest and say, "Spike, you got a beer gut," or "Hey, you're not so good in this scene." And are you feeling that on this show? Are you okay with it? Or
listen, I'll be totally honest with you, and you're not going to believe me on this one, but I love getting feedback or even a take on from anyone.
That's
because
smart.
I grew up in a theater family where everyone was contributing and collaborating. So listen, you can get a note from anyone that makes sense. So I really like that because it's really all mm-hmm. about trying to figure out how to get better. And
so where are we? You have the pilot shot. You just had it at the upfronts. How many episodes are they writing right now? What are you guys doing?
Yes, they really got ahead of the curve. They got their group, and Ted Humphries, who did The Good Wife, is doing it, and Adam Davidson directed it, mm-hmm. and they all did a brilliant job, and Adam is now one of our producers, so he's sticking around with us. And they gave us the time slot Sunday nights after 60 minutes, so it can't be awful.
Fantastic.
You know what I mean?
That's perfect.
Kind of, yeah.
And where are you shooting it?
We're shooting it at CBS Radford.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, your
wow.
old your old Diggs.
And your old Larry Sanders place,
yes,
too.
Yes, absolutely.
Did we know each other back then? Because we were right next door.
I didn't.
I loved you on that show, and I loved that show.
Thank you.
All of the Seinfeld writers loved Larry Sanders.
Yeah.
And we were getting love back from you guys.
Yeah,
it's funny. Nobody liked their own show.
Well, I think what was happening was obviously you guys were the Beatles, and like, you know, and we were this
you were the Rolling Stones.
No,
you were cooler than we were.
No, I think that because listen, that show, the Larry Sanders Show, was the show that kind of was the first to kick off original programming on HBO. So it was kind of like a well kept secret
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was for those who knew, and it was nice to, I didn't know that you guys until later had the love. And I ran.
Well, I came from Letterman. I was a Letterman writer. So Paul Sims, who went out to write for you guys,
exactly.
he would talk about the weird intern in your show, and I knew the weird intern.
Exactly.
I would call Paul and go, is that our weird intern? He'd go, yeah, that's our weird intern.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, we were, or at least I heard, he would go back there and he'd soak up some of the stories of the staff, and that was very fresh in my head and fun to hear you guys doing them.
Well, yeah, we had, I mean, think about it. Sims and Judd Apatow and Gary Shandling and
your character was a writer on the show.
You know, I was just a kid who was there, and I was played the head writer, and I just kind of decided that I would play him as a guy who wasn't funny,
uh-huh.
but was the head writer, and knew he wasn't funny, and the kind of tragedy of like, oh my God, what if they realize that I'm a complete and utter charlatan. So that was a blast. And then I run into your casting director, Mark Hirschfeld.
Mark Hirschfeld, right.
And he said, you know, I'm... Interesting moment.
Yeah, that was Robert Morton who just walked by and
pretending.
Did a blowjob.
That was an interesting
move
moment.
Of some kind.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know that we're talking about Letterman, and he was the producer of Letterman.
Amazing.
He was what a strange coincidence. That's a little bit of the magic of the porch here.
I love it.
And in the middle of the story, there's the producer of David
Beautiful.
Letterman walking
making
by,
making a lewd. I wish that was visual. He just assaulted us visually.
we could Zuckerman. You could handle that case. Could you? So let's get some money out of that.
So because I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to get back to talking about myself.
Yeah, let's quickly go there, and then I want to talk about the target, and then we have to go. So
okay. So basically for me, that was like my graduate school. There I was in scenes with Jeffrey Tambor and the great Rip Torn and obviously the brilliant Gary Shandling. And I was kind of like the sixth man off the bench. You
mm-hmm.
know, I didn't have a lot to do, but I got to be around these brilliant people, and I just took it all in and just was just lucky to be there.
Yeah. Wow, that is a
and
great
And then auditioned
way.
For you guys. And I remember Mark said to me, you know, would you like to come in and audition for Seinfeld? And to be totally honest with you, and I'm going to be – this is blasphemous what I'm about to say. But I lived in a pool house while I was filming Larry Sanders. And I remember Sims came over to my house and he's like, you're a regular on a TV show. Why are you in the pool house? I was like, I don't know. I like it. And he's like, no, you got to get like a proper home somewhere. But I didn't have a TV, so I'd never seen your show. I'd never seen Seinfeld. And so they were like, would you like to audition to play George Costanza? And I didn't know what she was talking about. And I was like, well, who plays that? And they're like, Jason Alexander. I was like, oh, I know Jason. So they're like, come on in. I'm like, listen, I'm on this other show, the Larry Sanders Show. He's like, well, listen, if you can, come in. I was like, oh, okay. I'm an actor, and we just can't even turn down. We're pathetic.
No, you're on cable. That's different.
Yeah, well,
you're on cable. This is network.
This is
at the time, that meant something.
It meant something, but also just a job is a job, you know. We're just like
mm-hmm.
hungry, scrappy freaks.
Of course.
And so I went in, and I auditioned, and I did my best Jason Alexander impersonation. And I remember in the room they were just like, oh, my God, you must be such a huge fan of the show. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I've never seen the show. And I did the show.
He's never seen it.
I did the show without having seen the show.
Wow.
But I knew you guys were rock stars, and Jerry was incredibly sweet and humble. And, I mean, I probably was in, you know, one of the most un-American people ever to step on that set.
Because
you know, I know it sounds disrespectful, and I apologize for not seeing the
Look,
show.
Look, I'll tell you
it's
a secret.
Wonderful confession. You're golden.
I was writing, I came on in the seventh season, and when I was asked to come submit stories, I had not really seen the show either.
There we go.
And it was because I was working on Letterman till around 10 o'clock every night. And the way I prepared for that writer's submission was I read Jerry's books of stand-up, and just to get his rhythms of what he talked about
and
what
amazing.
He liked.
And does he know that? This is the ultimate. Oh, he doesn't know it.
He does not know that.
Oh, my God.
Don't tell
him.
He's not going to listen to this.
He will listen to this.
I had never seen the show. And to this day, I still haven't seen most of the series.
Oh, my God.
I've seen 7, 8, and 9, and maybe the contest, and a couple others. I haven't really even seen your episode. I've seen snippets of it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, wait. Let's talk cars, because we have to go.
Yes.
Jeremy Piven is looking for an early 911 Targa. He loves colors like signal oranges and yellows and Conda greens, but I don't think he's going to buy that. I think you're more, this would be your first 911.
Yeah.
You're probably silvers and maybe black or metallic
grays. No, you know what? I would pull the trigger on green. There's something about that green. I remember you were Jerry had that the other day.
I sent you a picture of one that was on the Fox lot.
I would get that tomorrow.
You can check that out on my Instagram feed. It had a license plate on the back that was Kermit. I think it was a Viper green car. It's a very bright green, but you would get into something like that?
Oh my God, absolutely.
All right. Well, if you're listening and you have that car, get in touch with me and I'll send it to Mr. Piven and
absolutely.
Perhaps he'll buy it. And it's a perfect car for you. What else do you drive? Do you just drive the Bronco right now? Do you have?
You know, I drive the Bronco and I've tried various cars, and ultimately, you know, when I start my job next month, I'm going to have to get there on time.
Right.
So
what is your shoot schedule? Just 7 days a week and...
No, no, we do. We'll do.
Why do you laugh? I thought that's the way.
No, that's funny.
Mark Harmon lives in my neighborhood,
okay.
Right? And I see him twice a year, right before the season starts, walking his dog, and then when the season ends. And I said, what do you do between these times? He goes, I'm shooting. I'm always shooting.
That scares me. That scares me.
But Mark Harmon is very, very wealthy. You're
right.
Going to make so much money on this show. Zuckerman. Money, Zuckerman.
Money to squander
cars.
You know what, man? I got to tell you, you know.
It means nothing to you.
Well, you know, who doesn't want to have a little bit of freedom?
You're like me. I like just getting paid to be in this business. That's it. It doesn't matter how much. I just enjoy that I'm not out re-roofing houses or laying asphalt or doing the real work I used to do back in Massachusetts.
Yeah, we're just
We're
very lucky. Here's what's funny is, like, you mentioned auditioning. I basically auditioned with my new show, Wisdom of the Crowd, in the way that I was talking to Kevin Spacey recently, and he said that the reason why he did House of Cards on Netflix is because they were the only people that came to him and said, you don't have to do a pilot. We'll give you 2 seasons on the air. And they were like, this is perfect. But with me, I figured I'm going to go do a pilot. Les Moonves and everyone at CBS will either like it or they won't. So there's something fun about that rite of passage,
mm-hmm.
where it's like you've got to go to Vancouver, bust your ass and grind, and they're either going to take it or they don't. So,
but you're lucky here that you're shooting here in L.A. You're shooting in Studio City.
I did have a say in that. I basically said, if we're going to do it, we got to do it in L.A.
Yeah.
So once they said that, I was like, oh, my God, how could you possibly turn that down? But listen... You know,
he's a powerful man, Zuckerman, that he can do that. You know how hard that is to bring a production to you?
Powerful.
Very hard. You got to have pull. You got to have juice.
Gravity.
That's why he's so humble. He's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
If you're truly powerful, you don't have to take your sword out, do you, Zuckerman? You just walk in the room.
Self-deprecation all
day
long.
That's right.
I like this podcast. This is good for my
ego.
That's
the way it works.
I'm going to come here. I don't live too far from here. I'll be your Ed McMahon. I'll just, like, giggle
in
the background.
I'm going to be bringing you a car soon. I'm sorry I couldn't get one here today, but thank you for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
The new show is Wisdom of the Crowd. It's on CBS, The Big Time, coming Sundays this fall, 8/7 Central. Jeremy Piven.
Thank you guys for having me.
All right, my friend.
Porchcast.
We'll see you next week, folks.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.